This is TNT Music, brand new release in 2025. The song is called FTV. It's featuring the great Nico. Taking our listeners to South Africa. From Pittsburgh to the rest of the world. Hello! It's Saturday night, and if you're looking for some great craft beers in Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh is one of the cities that have got some great craft beer. I know there's people around the U.S. that claim they've got the best craft beer. But let me just run a few craft beer institutions or destinations you should go to. Gristhouse Craft Brewery, which is known for its hazy IPAs and creative seasonal beers. Their rotating taps and friendly tap rooms make it a go-to for locals. East End Brewing Company. East End Brewing Company, a longtime favorite among locals here in Pittsburgh for their solid year-round beers and creative seasonal options. Chatch Brewworks, it's another famous one, a classic Pittsburgh spot, brewing on-site inside a former church with standout beers like their Dunkel Ale, also a fun atmospheric place to visit. You can take photographs. It's amazing how people transform our places. Brew Gentleman Beer Company. Great craft IPAs and small batch releases with a laid-back vibe for enjoying good beer and good company. Some good bar food there as well. Dancing Gnome Brewery. Famous for bold and flavorful New England IPAs and a rotating tap list that draws beer lovers from across the region. I was recently in Colorado and they were telling me they have the best craft beers, and I was going back and forth and saying no, in Pittsburgh we have the best craft beers. It's just amazing how people break their ice to have conversations when you're traveling. One of the things I love about traveling is getting to understand, getting to know what's happening in other parts of the world. Colorado was great. made some great friends, went to a couple of lounges and exchanged conversations and shared with them the Tembo Sounds, a culture show. Hopefully you're listening. Hopefully you're catching us live. And if you don't catch us live, you can catch the podcast on demand at tembosounds.com. Or just do a search for the Tembo Sound Show on any of the podcast outlets and you'll catch us on demand, baby. A lot of Pittsburgh people agree with me. They love the Grist House Brewery. And if you're in Mount Lebanon, you can go to Boozy Barrels just down the road. They have a great selection of six-pack beers. They also have a speakeasy kind of bar in their establishment. And listen, man, it's one of those places where it's a good vibe. It's chilled. Great bartenders, great staff, great people that come through it. And that's Boozy Barrels right here in Mount Lebanon, Mount Lebanon Boulevard. Say hi to my friends at Boozy Barrels. Hello, hello, hello. (412) 499-5000. That's my telephone number. 412-499-5000. We love our local businesses. And for those of you who've not been to Pittsburgh or you're visiting Pittsburgh, you can check out some of these establishments I'm mentioning. Yeah? Can't go wrong. I'm your ambassador, Dr. Kenya Osiradoli. quick update for our soccer listeners, our soccer fans, our football fans. The FIFA 2026 World Cup draw is complete, with 48 teams now placed in the 12 groups of four. The host nation, United States national soccer team, lands in Group D, paired with Paraguay's national team, Australia's national team, and the winner of the European playoffs that's taking place right now. Other groups you should think about is Brazil's national football team is grouped with Morocco. Morocco's national team is going to be a very strong team, or rather difficult pool. Scotland, Haiti. Can you believe it? Haiti's in the World Cup. Haiti. Barely struggling to put it together, yet their soccer team is qualified for the World Cup. Big ups to Haiti for that really awesome achievement. The expansion to 48 teams, that's pretty a lot. The expansion to 48 nations and 104 matches makes this the biggest World Cup ever. We're anticipating promising drama, surprises, and that global soccer, global football energy. Now, the World Cup is going to be played in the United States. It's also going to be played in Mexico, and it's also going to be played in Canada. So they'll be splitting those games and those pool games in those three countries. Get your tickets. Make sure you are booking some time off for vacation. Actually, taking a holiday. Don't take a vacation. Take a holiday where you can just relax and enjoy. Yeah? Temo Sounds of Culture, 412-499-5000. Soccer World Cup games are going to be played in this cities in the US: Atlanta, Georgia, Mercedes-Benz Stadium, Boston's Foxborough, Dallas, Arlington, Texas, the AT&T Stadium, Houston, Texas, the NRG Stadium, Kansas City, Missouri, Arrowhead Stadium, in LA, Los Angeles, Inglewood, California, the SoFi Stadium. Miami Gardens, Florida's Hard Rock Stadium. In New York and New Jersey, you know, New York and New Jersey always doing things differently. It's going to be played in the MetLife Stadium. The World Cup final is going to be here at the MetLife Stadium in New York and New Jersey, yeah? And in Pennsylvania, the games are going to be in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania's Lincoln Financial Field. For those of you in Pittsburgh that want to travel, you can do that. I'm surprised that there's no game in Ohio. Usually Ohio is a big place that has a big football following, big soccer following. They have the two cities of San Francisco, the Santa Clara, California Levi's Stadium, and Seattle, Washington's Lumen Field are the cities where the World Cup is going to be played in the U.S. In Canada, we have Vancouver and Toronto. In Mexico, we have Mexico City, Monterrey, and Guadalajara. In want to say thank you very much for those who took the time to communicate with me. It's always a pleasure to engage. This is a community radio show for community members in Pittsburgh and across the world. It's Temple Sounds of Culture. It's what we do. We enjoy great music cultures. Thanks for the phone calls. I know sometimes it takes me long to move on to the next song, but that's because I'm engaging with other listeners. And there's nothing is better than having them in the mix, listening to the mix with I, Dr. Kenya, Oscar Redoli. We're wrapping up the show. Like I said, if you missed the Temple Sounds of Culture show, if you want to catch any other shows, please don't hesitate. Do a search for Temple Sounds and any of the podcast outlets, and you'll find us there. 99% of the shows are family-friendly. We believe great music can be shared and enjoyed by people in families, frenemies, in the office, in the workspace, because we're mature like that sometimes. Have a wonderful night. Good night, everybody.
WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is the stormy weather.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a militarized U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration force declared they had taken out drug traffickers in the Caribbean, killing some of them in what was presented as a successful operation. Locals on the ground reported differently, saying these people weren't drug traffickers, just human beings who happened to be on the river and got shot up by U.S. forces who were not attacked, as they claimed, but just killed innocent people because they were given orders to kill them. It should sound familiar, but this isn't today in Venezuela. It's 2012 in Honduras. An inspector general review from the State Department and the Justice Department found that no, this was not a Honduran operation or a joint operation the DEA were helping with. It was a DEA operation, and it killed four innocent people and injured others in a remote Afro-Indigenous part of Honduras. The story that the DEA pushed on Congress and on the press corps was just a lie. But you'd hardly know that history reading current coverage of Honduras, where, as we record on December 4th, the presidential election is still in question. Not in question, the U.S.'s long history of intervening violently, dramatically, unaccountably in Honduras. We'll talk about it with Alex Main, Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. Media coverage focuses on violence. If it bleeds, it leads. Yeah, but only some violence, sometimes. How much have you read, for example, about Amber Zeck? She was a 20-year-old welder in Minnesota, and as the 19th's Jessica Kutz notes in one of the rare media acknowledgments, quote, women make up just 6% of welders in the country, and as with other male-dominated occupations, it came with the risk of isolation and bullying, close quote. Well, in Zeck's case, that bullying ended with a male coworker bludgeoning her to death because, as he told law enforcement, he didn't like her and had been planning to murder her for some time. I saw reports on this from tradeswomen outlets, from social media, from some local outlets, but so far it doesn't seem to rate as a national story. It has nothing to tell us, evidently, about broader trends or influences. In this case, it seems it's just an errant individual and nothing to see here. The 19th reports that the Tradeswomen Task Force and Equal Rights Advocates, a nonprofit focused on gender justice in workplaces, won a $350,000 grant last fall specifically to address gender-based violence in the workplace. The Trump administration canceled that program. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The BBC's December 3rd headline drops us right in. Quote, as lead changes in knife-edge Honduran election, will Trump fail to get his way? Close quote. What's going on in the Honduran general elections, and what does it have to do with Trump? And also, what do we lose when media report other countries' elections through the lens of U.S. power? Here to help us make sense of things is Alex Main. He's Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Welcome back to Counterspin, Alex Main.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Well, we are recording the morning of December 4th. Folks will be hearing it later, and I trust they'll understand that we are talking about what we know now. And whatever the outcome, the same factors are still in play. So we can't do it total justice, but if you could just set the stage a little. These elections in Honduras, yes, for president, but they're much broader than that, have been very fraught. Why is that? What is at stake here? And what makes it so hard to read, especially from outside Honduras?
Well, yes. I mean, Honduras has had a fraught history, really, and a lot of it has to do with the U.S. and its role in Honduras, which, you know, is often referred to or has been referred to in the past as the sort of quintessential banana republic, where, you know, basically U.S. corporations and the U.S. military have, you know, essentially had their way for well over a century now. You know, it started with bananas and the United Fruit Company, and today I think Honduras is seen as a very geostrategic location for the U.S. They have their most important military base with Task Force Bravo in Sotocano, which is, you know, not far from the capital city of Honduras, Tegucigalpa. And that base has been active since the 1980s, when it was a sort of a launch pad for the U.S. in its interventions in Central America, and primarily in Nicaragua, where, of course, it was supporting the Contra insurgency against the Sandinistas who came to power in 1979. And, yeah, beyond just Sotocano, the base, there were lots of airfields in remote parts of Honduras where the CIA flew, you know, weapons and munitions to Contra forces in Nicaragua throughout the war there in the 1980s. And, you know, that was done with the complete acquiescence of the Honduran government. And I think you know, Honduras, perhaps more than any other country in that region, had historically been the most pliant government towards the U.S. and really allowing the U.S. to, you know, use it very freely to intervene throughout the region.
Someone reminded me that people used to call it USS Honduras, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Much was it seen as a staging ground for U.S. actions in the region.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. And that may seem anachronistic and sort of a relic of the Cold War, but we're currently seeing, you know, a remilitarization of the region, you know, under this Trump administration. I mean, it was already heavily militarized, but now it's reaching really new levels with, you know, close to 20% of U.S. naval forces. They're now concentrated in the Caribbean, these threats of war against Venezuela. And the U.S. has been, you know, very aggressively seeking the support and the infrastructure of countries in the region to, again, serve as a sort of a launch pad to intervene militarily, currently potentially in Venezuela, but also other countries that could include Colombia, that could include Mexico. You know, really depends on the whims of the current president of the United States, but all is a part of this sort of new war on narco-terror. So I would say, you know, Honduras remains perhaps, you know, more geostrategic than ever in the eyes of the folks in charge now in Washington, D.C., and, you know, that has had a huge influence on, you know, what happens in the country, because the U.S. has just an enormous amount of economic influence there. Honduras is heavily dependent not just on trade with the U.S., but also on remittances from Hondurans that are in the U.S. They're a big part of, you know, the annual GDP of the country. And so, you know, every little thing that the U.S. does and says regarding Honduras really has huge effects in the country, effects that are very rarely noted here in the U.S. in the media and so on. But in these elections, they have gotten some
Some attention. I'm looking at this BBC piece, but not because it's special, more because it's not special, you know, and it states straight out, you know, many in Honduras see the U.S. president's fingerprints all over this election. So what are they talking about there?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, at this point, we don't know who the winner of the election is. You know, today and December 4th, you know, but we do know who has not won the election, and that is Rixi Moncada from the current left-wing Libre party that rules the country under President Xiomara Castro currently. She is in a distant third place, and it's currently sort of a toss-up between Alfura from the National Party and Salvador Nasralla from the Liberal Party. And the National Party and the Liberal Party are the two parties that shared power in Honduras for decades following, you know, the end of the military dictatorship in Honduras in the mid-1980s. So we're seeing, you know, sort of a return to the past, in a sense, with these two parties that are really very closely aligned. They're both quite conservative. They're very close to the U.S. And have always sort of deferred to the U.S. in terms of its foreign policy agenda in the region and in the world. And, of course, that's how U.S. administrations, whether this one or previous ones, have sort of always liked it in Honduras, to them represents stability, not stability for Honduras necessarily, but stability for U.S. interests in that country and in the region. So what we've seen that's very striking is just a level of interference that I don't think we've ever seen in a Honduran election before, where, you know, President Trump just days before the election took place this last Sunday, November 30th, he publicly endorsed the National Party candidate, Asura, and he announced as well that he was going to be pardoning Juan Orlando Hernandez, the former National Party president of Honduras, who served illegally two terms as president of the country from, I think, 2014 to 2022, and who was heavily involved in corruption and in drug trafficking, and ended up extradited to the U.S. and ended up sentenced to over 40 years in jail.
Just can we just put a pin in the drug trafficking? Just put a pin there in the convicted of drug trafficking, which is
right.
I mean, you know, irony is dead, but please continue. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. So, you know, that was again the kind of most heavy interference that we've seen from a U.S. president in an election in Honduras. Perhaps in Latin America, at least publicly. You know, there's always, of course, a lot going on behind the scenes,
right?
And that, as I'm sure, has certainly been the case in these elections. But this is, you know, overtly through Truth Social posts, backing this candidate, accusing both of the other candidates of being communists. You know, one, supposedly openly a communist, which I guess is maybe the most sort of bad word in Trump's sort of political lexicon, but accusing Rixi Moncada of the Libre Party of being a communist, and then also accusing Mastrana of being sort of a communist in disguise, who's there to thwart the chances of the National Party candidate. Absurd claims, but in any case, you know, any sort of statement like this was bound to have huge repercussions in Honduras. I think, you know, it's a country that's still recovering from a coup that took place back in 2009, a coup that the U.S., you know, helped enable during the Obama administration.
And I wanted to actually do a little just revisit to that, because, you know, when I say USS Honduras, when you say Banana Republic, people may think that's before I was born, you know. But first of all, it's not. And then also, we have very recent salient history. And I really just would like to take the moment to go back to that 2009 coup against Mel Zelaya, because then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had a role, but she scrubbed that role from her memoir, Hard Choices. Give me a break. When that memoir came out in paperback, Hillary Clinton chose to erase her role in the 2009 coup in Honduras. And I think that's fascinating.
Yes.
If you're proud of it, why erase it?
So let's very revealing chapter.
Exactly.
That was taken out of the paperback edition. One where she proudly, you know, explained her role in preventing the elected president of Honduras, who hadn't finished his term and had been ousted in a coup and forced into exile. She proudly described her role in preventing him from getting back into office. And by doing that, you know, essentially it allowed this coup against Mel Zelaya, the elected president, to succeed. The election that took place, that was supported by the U.S. and virtually no other country in the hemisphere, was carried out in, extremely unfair conditions, extreme repression that was going on following the coup, extreme censorship, an exclusion of candidates, and of course, in a situation where there was a de facto government, there you know, wasn't a democracy. Democracy had not been restored. You know, even though that's what all the other countries in the region were calling for, but the U.S., you know, essentially prevented that from happening because they didn't want someone like Melzelaya, who was from, you know, one of the two traditional political parties from the Liberal Party, but who had essentially gone rogue and aligned himself with left-wing social movements in the country, demanding some, you know, very deep reforms, particularly to the Constitution, which had been written during the military dictatorship of Honduras. It's very conservative and had a lot of constraints, and helped sort of maintain a kind of a neoliberal system in place. So he represented a real threat to the perceived interests of the U.S. His social movement base, you know, was very much opposed to a continued U.S. military presence in the country. And I think, you know, that's still today a very thick red line for, you know, a lot of U.S. Policymakers, certainly those that have directed U.S. policy towards Latin America from the State Department and Department of Defense and so on for decades.
I'm going to ask you to come back to social movements in Honduras in just a second, but I did want to, first of all, read Hillary Clinton's own words. Quote, we strategized on a plan to, she's talking about conversations with Mexican Foreign Secretary Patricia Espinosa after the 2009 coup. Quote, we strategized on a plan to restore order in Honduras and ensure that free and fair elections could be held quickly and legitimately, which would render the question of Zelaya moot and give the Honduran people a chance to choose their own future, close quote. Just the perversity of the language. And then I want to pin it to the quote from current U.S. Representative Maria Salazar from Florida, who's describing that same 2009 military coup, quote, then the Honduran democracy stood strong. Thank God for that. And the armed forces abided by their duty to uphold democracy, and Mr. Zelaya was out of office, close quote. And I read those quotes just to alert us to the use of language, to the use of the sort of weaponization of the term democracy and free and fair, because we know what happened, and then this is how it is described, and this includes, you know, news media, you know, as late as, right. Let me get my note here, 2017, the New York Times is saying, quote, in 2009, after the Honduran military removed the leftist president Manuel Zelaya from power in a midnight coup, the United States joined other countries in trying to broker, albeit unsuccessfully, a deal for his return, close quote.
Right.
This is just, it's just false, you know? So in other words, if the U.S. is so proud of their involvement in Honduras, you know, and the region, why lie about it? You know, why?
That's right.
Why scrub it?
Yep. Well, Hillary Clinton didn't lie about it in the first edition of her book, but then realized that it became a little bit awkward and you know, contradicted sort of the official narrative. If I may, I'd also like to point your listeners to Hillary Clinton's emails. Remember the big batches of emails that were released in 2015. Now, they contained even more evidence of her very active role in preventing Melzelaya from returning to office. I wrote an article about this that you can find on our website at cepr.net called Hillary Clinton's Emails in the Honduras Coup. Mm-hmm. So we don't need to go into the details now, but there's a lot more that she did behind the scenes And, you know, we discovered a lot more in those emails. But that got very little attention from New York Times and other major outlets.
And certainly isn't part of her, you know, persona now, you know, as she reinvents herself. Well, I said I'd bring you back to social movements because, you know, as your colleague Mark Weisbrot wrote recently, a number of things were unleashed in the wake of that coup. And you've talked about the decline in human rights and an increase in femicide in particular, and just a number of drastic, difficult things that happened. And then other things also happened, which were a growth in Afro-Indigenous and Indigenous movements. Counterspin listeners will know about Berta Cáceres, you know. That coup unleashed bottom-up work and social justice work as well, and that we should acknowledge continues.
No, absolutely. I think it'll be continuing more than ever. I mean, if there is a silver lining to this election, which again, I think was shaped a lot by U.S. interference, I think it's that this gives Libre and the social movements a time, a moment to sort of reassess and rebuild themselves. You know, in the process of coming to power, Libre entered a power structure that, in a certain sense, absorbed it. It went in a direction that I think a lot of the social movements is happy with. And there was, you know, even though for the most part, I think this sort of key movements like Ofrene and Copin that represent sort of Afro-Indigenous communities in Honduras, they absolutely called on Hondurans to vote against the bipartidismo, the bipartisan liberal and national party, you know, alliance. But they weren't very enthusiastically supportive of Libre, and I think there is an opportunity now for the Libre party to kind of refind its roots that, you know, were very much based in social movement resistance and, you know, perhaps get more direction from that going forward. But at the same time, you know, under another either national party or liberal party government at this stage, we don't know which it will be, there's likely to again be a lot of repression of the social movements. And so that's something that's very important to monitor because it won't get much attention. It didn't get much attention after the coup. It didn't get much attention at all during the two terms of Juan Orlando Hernandez. Again, illegal terms because the Constitution actually prevented him from being reelected. But also because in 2017, there are pretty clear indications that there was fraud during those elections carried out by the National Party. And there were huge protests in response to that fraud, and those protests were very violently repressed. You had over 30 protesters that were killed. The military was unleashed against the protesters. And that government has a terrible human rights record, but also a record of, you know, very endemic corruption throughout the institutions. There were huge protests against the corruption as well that didn't get much notice. And it's almost as if, you know, if you're a right-wing Latin American government that's aligned with the U.S., you get a free pass in the media. It doesn't get much notice if, you know, there's a corruption scandal, if there's repression. And, of course, in the case of Juan Orlando Hernandez, you know, there were a lot of signs of his deep involvement in drug trafficking for many years. And, you know, it was only after he left the presidency that the U.S. sort of actively pursued him for his involvement in drug trafficking. And now, really, he should be brought to justice in Honduras for his crimes there. But that seems unlikely to happen, you know, with either the Liberal Party or the National Party in power. You know, they look out for each other. And there's a long record of corruption in both those parties and a long record of impunity for the corruption that's taken place. And unfortunately, that's likely to continue.
And no reason to look for certainly corporate U.S. news media to cover that critically or to platform the voices of the social movements that will be working to challenge it.
That's right.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Alex Main. He's Director of International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can follow their work online at cepr.net. Thank you so much, Alex Main, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Michael Cherry. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Started. I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!